Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon with a phone line you can access, although the lines are full right now, but there will be lines opening up later. So if you have the number handy, you can call in. If you call in, we expect that you call in because you have a question you want to ask or a disagreement with the host that you'd like to register and talk about. So that's pretty much what we are, mainly a Q&A program. We've been on for 23 years. We're now on it, or this coming month, we will be on about 40 stations nationwide. Still a pretty small network compared to most nationwide programs, but it's slowly growing, and we've had, we've survived. It's very expensive to be on radio stations, but we've survived financially, and that's been due to the grace of God, and we're glad. So we've had thousands of calls to this program over the years. I don't know everything, and some things that that you might ask, I might not know the answer to. I won't pretend to know something I don't know. But because we've had so many thousands of calls over the last 23 years, there's a good chance that something you have a question about will be something that I've had occasion to look into and may be able to help out. The number to call will be 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And I will announce this because some of you know my dad. This is a promotion day for my dad. He actually went to heaven today, and I learned of it about 10 minutes ago. So I did announce at the end of the program yesterday that my father had a hematoma had been found in his brain, and that he had lost all his higher functions, though he was still breathing in a hospital room. And he was put, last night, I guess, into a hospital hospice situation. And we knew he'd go either today or tomorrow. And I just got news that he went. But where he went is to a place that I desire to go, and I don't grieve over him going there. It'll be hard for some of us. He left three kids, all Christians, and he was of course a good Christian man, so we have no doubts about him. And my mom's a very strong Christian woman too. She's taken it well, but she will no doubt be extremely sad and have time adjusting, because they were together as a very happy couple for about 71 years and are 72 that they knew each other. So it's my mother's whole life has been as a homemaker and a mother and a wife, and especially since my dad's 95 and he had a few health issues, she's given him a lot of care, and now of course her life is going to be redefined. If you want to pray for anybody, pray for my mom, for her to be able to adjust to this. She'll be fine. We're all fine. So you don't need to, when I answer your phone here, when I put you on the air, you don't have to, you're not obliged to, console us or anything like that. You can just go ahead and get to your question. Just since I mentioned yesterday, the reason I mentioned it at the end of the program yesterday rather than early is because I didn't want it to dominate the program. I wanted people to be able to, participate in the program without feeling some obligatory pressure to say, oh, so sorry for your dad. But we're not sorry for him. We'll miss him, and we'll be sorry for ourselves, but we're not sorry for him. He's a happy man. He was a happy man in life, and he's an even happier man now that he's gone to where Paul said is much better. And so it's his promotion. No more facing the things that I'm afraid I have to face in the next few years living in this country. It's one reason I envy him. But we'll all of us who are following Christ will be in that same place eventually. But there are hard times to come in all likelihood, and I'm very glad to have him spared them. enough on that for now. Let's talk to David from Las Vegas. David, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I had one comment and then kind of a serious question after that. I lost my mom on Christmas, and I'm very sorry for you. So that's that. But my comment was, and then I'll get to the question. My comment was, is there are times where I'll be listening to the word and really, really getting in the spirit, and I'll feel like I'm almost ready to just fully let go and go 9 feet in into the Christian walk, and I feel like my insides are about to explode out. It's the only way I can explain it, but I can't stay in that place, you know. And sometimes the guilt of that gets to me because I'm like, well, am I not fully surrendering, or is this a common ebb and flow that kind of happens with Christians, where you just, you know, the word comes alive and you feel like, you know, you feel like almost like one of the apostles, but you know, I'm hesitant to stay in that incredibly surrendered place for too long. And, that's what I,
well, I wouldn't equate the feelings that you're talking about, that is the, you know, the very positive feelings you're talking about, I wouldn't equate that with being in a very surrendered place. You might be in a very surrendered place, but you can be very surrendered whether you have any feelings about it or not. It's like you can be totally devoted to your wife or a woman to her husband, even when they don't have much feelings. You know, this is something people have lost sight of. We live in an age where so many things are evaluated by our emotions, when really there's better ways to evaluate them. Many marriages break up because the wife doesn't feel or the husband doesn't feel the same way toward their spouse as they felt on their honeymoon. And yet, to feel the same way through your whole marriage as you felt on your honeymoon is not a very normal thing. You know, life is not all about feelings, and it's more, in the case of relationships, about faithfulness, about being faithful to your spouse, being faithful to God. And to be totally devoted to God does not predict for any particular emotions. Now, I've had tremendous gratifying emotions in my Christian life. I've had highs and I've had lows, but that's speaking emotionally. In general, I've been I've certainly been as devoted to the Lord all through. You know, the emotions come and go, but devotion to God doesn't, just like in marriage, like I said. I hope that most people who have been married for years and don't feel as they felt on their honeymoon are not any less devoted to their spouse. And likewise, sometimes when people first get saved, or maybe they just reach a certain point in their life where they've got a newness in their relationship with God, that it feels like a honeymoon. And it's so exciting, you hardly know how to express it. But then, it's not that way all the time. And it's not supposed to be, necessarily. I mean, there's nothing in the Bible that says it is supposed to be. If someone says, well, I just have felt like I'm on my honeymoon with Jesus for the past 70 years. Well, wonderful. More power to you. But that's not most people's experience. I doubt if it was the apostles' experience. So, I mean, emotions are not what they valued most. Even love, which is the most important thing in the Christian life. Love for God, or love for other people. Those are the two things that matter, Jesus said. Love is not primarily emotion either. It certainly often is emotional. Everyone, I hope, listening to me knows the emotion of loving God or loving somebody. But love in the Bible is more to do with faithfulness and dedication. And it's what you do. For example, Jesus said that when he was asked by somebody how to love your neighbor as you love yourself, he gave the story of the what we call the Good Samaritan. And at the end of it, he said, who was it in the story who loved his brother? And, of course, it was the Samaritan. But we don't read much about the Samaritan's emotions. We are told that he is moved with compassion toward the man who is in trouble. But his love for his neighbor was seen in his dedication to serving him and putting his neighbor's needs above his own and so forth. And that's why Jesus even paraphrased the old command, you shall love your neighbor as you love yourself, which comes from the Old Testament. He paraphrased it, do to others what you'd want done to them. It's what you do that shows that you love. It's not how you feel. And the same thing is true of God. Jesus said, if you love me, keep my commandments. So whether you feel a surge of emotional love toward God at any given time or not, should not have any impact whatsoever on whether you're faithful and obedient to him. Obedience to him on a regular basis is the love of God. According to 1 John chapter 5, it says, this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome. That is, because we love him, we obey him, and it's not a burden to do so. But it doesn't say anything about emotions there. Now, again, I've had plenty of wonderful emotions in my Christian life as a, you know, toward God and so forth. But I don't worry. I don't worry if I'm not feeling such emotions at any given time. My relationship with God, the gauge of its intimacy or of its genuineness, is not the gauge of my emotions, and I don't think it should be for you either. But I'm not trying to discourage those emotions. I think emotions are a wonderful thing. What I'm trying to discourage is that you would let the emotional realm determine in your mind, you know, where you stand with God, because that's not how we measure that.
Well, I'm careful about letting my emotions get away from me, because, I mean, I don't want to, you know, run on this emotion and be completely wrong.
Well, there's a danger of that too. I mean, when emotions are given too much of a head and too much of a authority in our lives, sometimes we almost trust them too much. You know, we can't trust the absence of emotion to tell us that we're far from God, because we may be very near to God and not have the emotions that we might want to associate with that. But we can't allow the presence of emotions to determine that we really are close to God, because a person can be very far from God and have great emotions. I mean, every cultist can have the same emotions that a Christian has. Hindus and Buddhists can sometimes have emotions in their religion too. So, I mean, obviously having that, that's a mistake that Mormons often make. Their theology is not biblical, but they count on something they call the testimony, or the burning bosom, which is, you know, even if they know that their theology is shaky, they're sure they're right, because they had this experience, this burning bosom, which is, if nothing else, an emotional experience. They don't realize that people in most religions once in a while have those emotions too. So yeah. having emotions doesn't mean you're right with God, and not having them doesn't mean you're not right with God. So that's about as far as we can go on this, but I understand your concern, especially not to let your emotions carry you into a wrong area. You need to, however emotional you are, in your, or whatever great emotions may accompany your Bible reading, you need to make sure that you don't let them decide what you're going to believe and what you're going to follow. You need to let your solid, rational decisions to be obedient to God be based on his word and the wisdom that he gives. Anyway, I appreciate your call, brother. Thank you. I'm sorry, I was in the process of hitting the button to go to the next call when I heard you say my name. I apologize that I cut you off if you were going to say something more. Peter from London, UK is next. Hi, Peter. Welcome.
Oh, hi, Steve. I'm glad you're back with the Lord now. My question, so I've been listening to your series on biblical counsel for change. And am I being too harsh when I'm of the opinion that, you know, whether you have whether it's a mental health issue or, you know, an emotional hurt, that, you know, Christ is enough. You don't need a therapist or a psychologist or a medical examiner to then try and, resolve the issue that you have, whether it's mentally or emotionally. I mean, I don't know if that's a normative way to think, because I have Christian friends who say that, Jesus is obviously enough, but then he's given us all these medical practitioners to also help in that area. And I don't know, I'm of the opinion that I think I don't think mental health I think it's a spiritual issue. And you know, if you're finding that Christ, you know, just actually just going to him is not enough, then I don't think that's an issue with Christ. I think I'm not trying hard enough. I don't know if
I understand.
That makes sense.
I understand. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people say, well, you can't just hand out Bible verses like aspirin, or you can't just, you know, tell everyone that if they're in a crisis or traumatized that they just need to say a prayer. Sometimes it's more complex than that. I agree. I don't think anyone should just be handing out Bible verses like aspirins, although a Bible verse, if it's a well-chosen one, may contain the very truth that will set them free. And so that's a different issue. We're not saying that knowing Bible verses is what is the cure, but the truth of God, which we learn from the Bible and which we apply through the Holy Spirit, is the cure to a great number of the problems people have. Likewise, when people say, well, you can't just say a prayer when someone's traumatized. Well, you can, but I would agree that just saying a prayer isn't a magic wand. Praying is actually different than saying a prayer, in my opinion. I think that when we're praying, we're approaching God. I believe we're connecting with God. I believe we're making our requests known to God as children approaching their Father. That's praying. Saying a prayer can be done by people of every religion or even by an atheist when they're really in trouble. And saying a prayer isn't necessarily connecting with God. It can be, but it's not always so. You mentioned the series you're listening to. Some people may not know about it. It's a series of lectures. Like all the lectures at our website, it's free. And the series is called Biblical Counsel for a Change. And it does contrast psychological and psychiatric analyses of people's life problems with what the Bible actually teaches. And so what you're saying is that your view is if people are having psychological problems, Jesus is enough, but they may not be connecting with Jesus in a normative way. And I think that that's true in most cases. Now, as I mentioned, there are such things as medical issues, and God has not promised to heal every medical issue supernaturally. Your friend said, well, God has given us doctors. That is true. God has given us doctors for medical problems. But a medical problem is a physical problem that has a medical remedy. Unfortunately, many spiritual problems have been misdiagnosed as medical issues. And if they're not physical, they're spiritual. At least every problem I've ever encountered that people have come for counsel about are spiritual issues. Now, there are people who have physical issues. There's no question of it. There's people who might have a brain tumor or have a chemical imbalance, a thyroid problem, you know, things like that, hypoglycemia. These kinds of things often have a profound effect on the brain, the physical brain. And the physical brain is an organ like the physical lung or the physical stomach or the physical heart or any other physical thing. And because it's physical, if it's damaged, it is sometimes possible to remedy that damage or treat it with physical medicine. Okay, so I'm not denying that there are people who have physiological problems that have an impact on their brain and mental activity. There are. But I don't believe that there are as many of them as the atheists say. You see, medical science, a great number of people, both in the medical field and in the psychological and psychic field, do not have God in their thinking. A lot of them are atheists, but even if they're not atheists, they often are thinking in terms of training they've received from people who did not have God in their thinking either. You see, science today seems to feel they should proceed from the naturalistic, materialistic worldview, which means that people can't have a problem that's spiritual because there is nothing spiritual. Everything's physical. And therefore, if everything's physical, then even the things that you and I would call spiritual, they would have to explain in a physiological way because their worldview demands it. And when they do so, I think they often misdiagnose. For example, a thing like demon possession. We as Christians know, because the Bible informs us, that there is such a thing as demon possession. And people who have demons often are described as acting in ways that we might call psychotic or paranoid schizophrenic or in some other ways. Now, I'm not saying that everybody that seems psychotic or schizophrenic has a demon. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying that some people do. Some people have them. The Bible tells us that. And if a person has a demon, that's a spiritual problem. And a medical doctor is not going to be able to help much with that unless he's an exorcist or a Christian. A Christian exorcist. But even other spiritual problems, which aren't, identified as demon possession, can be spiritual in nature. For example, unforgiving, a person who harbors bitterness in their heart, or a person has unresolved guilt. Those are not medical issues. Those are spiritual issues. Those are issues in their spiritual life. And the Bible addresses those and gives us the answer to them. Anxiety and depression, although many people have been diagnosed drugs for those things, and maybe receive some relief from it, yet the Bible speaks of both of those things, depression, anxiety, unforgiveness, hatred, anger. These are spiritual issues, and the Bible instructs us in them. The thing is, it's a lot easier to go to a doctor and give a pill. And the people who say you can't just give out Bible verses as aspirin, to them I say you can't just give out pharmaceutical drugs to solve spiritual problems. I mean, it's more complex than that. Humans are physical and spiritual beings, and some of their problems are physical. Those ones that are, I would recommend a medical doctor in many cases for them. Those that are not physical but are spiritual, I would recommend that Jesus is alone what we need. And if we say, but I'm a Christian, I still have these problems, that's not what I said. I didn't say being a Christian. I said Jesus is the solution. There are many Christians who do not have a very close walk with Jesus, don't have as much faith as other people do, or don't have as much knowledge of what God has said, and don't believe what he says much. There are Christians who don't connect with Jesus at a level that is, frankly, available and possible to do. And if someone asked me once, where do you go when you need counseling? I've never gone anywhere for counseling. I mean, for counsel, like life decisions, I've sought counsel, but counseling, therapy, I never sought any therapy for anything. And I've been through some pretty traumatic things. I've had a wife who died. I've had two wives that abandoned me for other men. A pretty traumatic life in some cases, but I've never needed anything but God. He's all there is for me. And he's more than enough. Because those are not physical problems. If someone wanted to give me an antidepressant or something like that, I think, what in the world for? I don't need to be depressed. I've got joy unspeakable and full of glory. I've got a peace that passes understanding, things that doctors don't understand if they're not Christians. So this is my position, Peter. I think that I agree with you that a great number of things that people say, oh, we should go to a psychologist or a psychiatrist and get some meds for that or something. I think a lot of those things are being misdiagnosed by people who don't know enough about God or about the Bible, or don't believe in those things. And so they're given a physiological interpretation to behavior that is really spiritually rooted and can be healed through spiritual adjustments and so forth, and obedience, and maybe even exorcism in some cases. Those things are all true, but it's also true that there are people who have actual physiological issues, some chemical issues, some, other kinds of physical injuries and so forth that make them act erratically. So I would say that the answer has got to be nuanced. We've got to be able to determine when a problem is physiological and when it's spiritual. Because if we try to apply spiritual remedies to physiological problems, they won't always be adequate. And if we try to give, medical remedies for spiritual problems, they will, barely touch it.
No, I think, Steve, I think the danger as well is when you also have Christian psychologists or Christians that in the medical field that also diagnose it such a mistakenly.
The problem is a psychologist, a Christian psychologist or a secular psychologist, if they've got some kind of a degree in psychology or a psychiatrist who's a medical doctor who also has some kind of training in people's mental issues, if they think they know everything about human problems, they're wrong. And most of them who have virtually everybody who's been trained in universities as a psychologist has been trained in theories that were invented by atheists I mean, frankly, Sigmund Freud was an atheist. Carl Jung was not an atheist. He was an occultist. He had a spirit guide. You know, people like Carl Rogers and Maslow and so forth, they were humanists. They weren't believers in the Bible. So their theories about human behavior and human problems totally lacked any insight into the spiritual nature of man. So, you know, if I want to become a Christian psychologist, I'm going to have to study under professors who studied under professors who studied under professors who studied these guys. And so even though a man can be a Christian and a psychologist, his psychology in most cases is not going to come from the Bible, because the Bible isn't a psychological book. It's a book about our spiritual life. Listen, I need to move along. I do appreciate your call always. We're not done. We have another half hour ahead, so don't go away. We just want to let you know that the Narrow Path is listener supported. It's not commercially supported. We don't have commercials, don't have sponsors, don't have anything that we sell. We don't sell anything at our website or over the air. We just let you know. We pay bills to be on the air. And if you'd like to help us do that, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can donate from the website where everything is free. That's thenarrowpath.com. I'll be right back.
Tell your family, tell your friends, tell everyone you know about the Bible radio show that has nothing to sell you but everything to give you. And that's The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. When today's radio show is over, go to your social media and send a link to thenarrowpath.com, where everyone can find free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. And tell them to listen live right here on the radio. Thank you for sharing listener-supported The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for another half hour taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, we would be glad to talk to you here. The lines are full at the moment, but they do open up in the course of the half hour. So if you have a number ready, you can dial it just the right time. And I can't tell you what that time will be. Take your chances. You may get in, and people do throughout the hour of our broadcast. New callers get through, even when the lines are full at the beginning. The number to call is 844-484-5737. And our next caller today is Franklin, Franken, it says, maybe misspelled, maybe Franklin, or Franken, in North Texas. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon, Steve. It's Frank.
Listen. I'm sorry. Well, it's Frank in. Okay, I got it. Frank in North Texas. Okay,
that's
I didn't
okay.
get it.
I answered most things. Listen, well put on the physical and spiritual difference. I mean, that's good stuff. Real quick, I'm a little bit hung up on Exodus chapter 3, verse 20, just on one word. And I'll read it real quick. It says Exodus 3, verse 20, "So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my wonders, which I will do in its midst. And after that, he will let you go." All my wonders, all my wonders. Does that mean something? Wonders, does that mean something different than what we're used to? Wonders is a good thing. I mean, I'm sure they're talking about the plagues, correct?
Yes, the 10 plagues. Uh huh.
Right, right. And how? Well, I mean, how do we call that wonders? I mean, it's.
Well, there's a number of words that the Bible uses for miracles. And there are different kinds of miracles. It's not uncommon to read about signs and wonders. A sign is a miracle that actually communicates something, actually stands for something. For example, Jesus' miracles that are in John. John's gospel refers to them as signs. Repeatedly, he calls them signs. And every miracle that John records, and there's not very many in the Gospel of John, only about seven, every one of them corresponds to some message, like Jesus is the light of the world, and he opened the eyes of the blind. Jesus is the bread of life, and he fed the multitudes. Jesus is the true vine, and he turns water into wine. He's the resurrection of the life, and he raises a man from the dead. These are instances where the miracles of Jesus are not just miracles for the sake of doing a miracle, but they carry information, and they're called signs. Like signs do carry information. Now, wonders simply refers to a miracle that is astonishing, something that's
awesome.
An astonishment, awesome, wonders. Yeah, so it's not, they can be good or bad, but in the case of the plagues brought on Egypt, they certainly were astonishing miracles, so they qualify as wonders. And if we think of them as, oh, but those are negative wonders, well, they're negative to the Egyptians. They're good for the Israelites. I mean, every time the Israelites saw one of those wonders occur, they knew they were closer to being delivered from their bondage. So a wonder is not in itself a positive or negative experience for people. It may be a positive experience for some and negative for others. As when the pillar was leading Israel through the wilderness and the Egyptians were pursuing them, the same cloud was darkness for the Egyptians, which prevented them from traveling, and it was fire and light for the Israelites, so they could keep traveling all night and increasing the distance between them and their pursuers.
Good for one and bad for the other. And,
right.
We talked about this. It was a Bible study the other night, Wednesday night. And I know sometimes when you're reading something, there's almost a misinterpretation of a word.
Uh-huh.
And nothing's perfect. I understand that other than God. But I just didn't want to stumble over that. And okay.
When you find the word wonders, when you find the word wonders in the Bible, it doesn't mean it's wonderful in the sense that we would say that. We use the word wonderful to mean, you know, great,
that's,
and excellent.
That's where I go.
Yeah, but the Bible. But the Bible does use the word wonderful, you know, but it means full of wonder. It doesn't mean, you know, great or necessarily positive. I mean, God can work wonderful judgments too. But it means that they elicit wonder or awe. Is what the word wonder means in the Bible.
Okay, I'm good with that. Hey, I'll let you go. I know you got a lot of people waiting. God bless
yeah,
you.
I do.
Thank
you, Frank. Thank you, Frank.
Bye-bye.
God bless. Bye now. Okay, Mike in Denver, Colorado. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you so much for taking my call, Steve. And first of all, I did just want to offer my condolences on the passing of your father. You know, your show means so much to me as a younger person. I'm 24 years old, and I just thank you so much for being here for everyone, and it means a lot. So just thank you.
Sure.
I had a kind of a comment and a question today. So, Steve, you know, hearing you talk about your parents, that made me think of a question today. So many times our religious ideologies are kind of shaped as children, and our parents obviously have a big role in that. And I know personally religion played a big part in my life growing up due to my parents being put in a Christian school and being introduced to the Bible. And I wanted to ask you, when you were growing up, you know, how did your parents help you to form your faith in God, and how did you kind of come to realize that religion and Christianity was kind of the path you wanted to take in life? Thank you.
Oh, okay. Well, my parents, first of all, they spoke about, you know, Christ and the Bible and God, but more than they did that, they exhibited a Christian life. My parents were loving, happy, righteous living people, regular in church, but whether they've been regular in church or not, I think they would have still been the same kind of people. They didn't depend on church going for their Christianity, but they did raise us in church. And I have to say, some good things were planted in my life through going to church. And